See if you can see this, Sarah said. She sat down in front of me and faced the philodendron. A plume of the whitish light encircling her body erupted outward and engulfed the philodendron. The diameter of the plant's energy field, in turn, broadened by several feet. Damn, I exclaimed, which provoked laughter between the two friends. Soon I was laughing myself, conscious of the peculiarity of what was happening, but feeling absolutely no uneasiness at seeing quite readily phenomena I had totally doubted minutes earlier. I realized that the perception of the fields, rather than evoking a surrealistic sensation, actually made the things about me seem more solid and real than before. Yet at the same time, everything around me seemed different. The only reference I had for the experience was perhaps a movie which enhanced the color of the forest in order to make it seem mystical and enchanted. The plants, the leaves, the sky now all stood out with a presence and a slight shimmer that suggested life there, and perhaps consciousness, beyond our ordinary assumption. After seeing this, there would be no way to take a forest for granted again. I looked at Phil. Sit down and put your energy on the philodendron, I said. I'd like to compare. Phil appeared perplexed. I can't do it, he said. I don't know why. I looked at Sarah. Some people can and some can't, she said. We haven't figured it out. Marjorie has to screen her graduate students to see who can do it. A couple of psychologists are trying to correlate this ability with personality characteristics, but so far no one knows. Let me try, I said. Okay, go ahead, Sarah replied. I sat down again and faced the plant. Sarah and Phil stood at right angles to me. Okay, how do I begin? Just focus your attention on the plant, as though to inflate it with your energy, Sarah said. I looked at the plant and imagined energy swelling up inside it. Then after a few minutes, I looked over at the two. Sorry, Sarah said wryly. You're obviously not one of the chosen few. I shot a mock frown at Phil. Angry voices from the path below interrupted our conversation. Through the trees we could see a group of men passing, talking harshly among themselves. Who are those people? Phil asked, looking at Sarah. I don't know, she said. More folks upset with what we're doing, I guess. I looked back at the forest around us. Everything appeared ordinary again. Hey, I can't see the energy fields anymore. Some things bring you right down, don't they? Sarah remarked. Phil smiled and patted my shoulder. You can do it again any time now. It's just like riding a bicycle. All you have to do is see the beauty, then extend from there. I suddenly remembered to check the time. The sun was much higher in the sky, and a light mid-morning breeze swayed the trees. My watch showed 7:50 a.m. I guess I had better head back, I said. Sarah and Phil joined me. As we walked, I looked back at the wooded hillside. That's one beautiful place, I said. Too bad there aren't more places like this in the States. Once you see the energy fields in other areas, Phil said, you'll realize just how dynamic this forest is. Look at these oaks. They are very rare in Peru, but they grow here in Vicente. A cut forest, especially one that's been stripped of hardwoods in order to grow pines for profit, has a very low energy field. And a city, except for the people, has a different kind of energy altogether. I tried to focus on the plants along the path, but the act of walking disrupted my concentration. You're sure I'll see these fields again? I said. Absolutely, Sarah replied. I've never heard of anyone failing to duplicate the experience once they've seen them initially. We had a research ophthalmologist come through here once, and he got all excited after he learned to see the fields. Turned out he had been working with certain sight abnormalities, including forms of color blindness, and concluded that some people have what he called lazy receptors in their eyes. He had taught people how to see colors they'd never experienced before. According to him, Seeing energy fields was just a matter of doing the same thing, of waking up other dormant receptors, something that everyone theoretically can do. I wish I lived near a place like this, I said. Don't we all? Phil replied, then looked around me at Sarah. Is Dr. Haynes still here? Yes, Sarah said. He can't leave. Phil looked at me. Now there's a guy who's doing some interesting research on what this energy can do for you. Yeah? I said. I talked with him yesterday. The last time I was here, Phil continued, he was telling me about a study he would like to conduct in which he would look at the physical effects of merely being near certain high-energy environments, such as that forest back there. He would use the same measurements of organ efficiency and output to see the effect. Well, I already know the effect, Sarah said. Whenever I drive into this estate, I begin to feel better. Everything is amplified. I seem stronger. I can think more clearly and quickly. And the insights I have into all this and how it relates to my work in physics is amazing. What are you working on? I asked. Do you remember me telling you about the perplexing experiments in particle physics, during which these little bits of atoms appeared wherever the scientists expected them to be? Yes. Well, I've tried to expand this idea a bit with some experiments of my own. Not to solve the problems those guys were working on in subatomic particles, but to explore questions I told you about before. To what extent does the physical universe as a whole, since it is made up of the same basic energy, respond to our expectations? To what extent do our expectations create all the things that happen to us? The coincidences, you mean? Yes. Think of the events of your life. The old Newtonian idea is that everything happens by chance, that one can make good decisions and be prepared, but that every event has its own line of causation independent of our attitude. After the recent discoveries of modern physics, we may legitimately ask if the universe is more dynamic than that. Perhaps the universe runs mechanistically as a basic operation, but then also subtly responds to the mental energy we project out into it. I mean, why not? If we can make plants grow faster, maybe we can make certain events come faster or slower, depending on how we think. Does the manuscript talk about any of this? Sarah smiled at me. Of course. That's where we're getting these ideas. She began to dig around in her pack as we walked, finally pulling out a folder. Here's your copy, she said. I glanced at it briefly and placed it in my pocket. We were crossing the bridge and I hesitated a moment, observing the colors and forms of the plants around me. I altered my focus and immediately saw the energy fields around everything in my view. Both Sarah and Phil had wide fields which seemed to be tinted yellow-green, though Sarah's field occasionally flashed with a pinkish color. Suddenly, they both stopped and looked intently up the trail. Ahead about 50 feet, a man walked quickly toward us. A sensation of anxiety filled my stomach, but I was determined to maintain my view of the energy. As he approached, I recognized him. He was the taller of the scientists from the University of Peru who had asked for directions the day before. Around him, I could detect a layer of red. When he walked up to us, he turned to Sarah and condescendingly said, "You're a scientist, aren't you?" "That's right," Sarah replied. "Then how can you tolerate this kind of science? I've seen these gardens and I can't believe the sloppiness. You people haven't controlled for anything." There could be many explanations for certain plants growing larger. "Controlling for everything is impossible, sir. We're looking for general tendencies." I could detect an edge growing in Sarah's voice. "But postulating some newly visible energy that underlies the chemistry of living things? That's absurd. You have no proof." "Proof is what we're looking for. But how can you postulate the existence of anything before you get some proof?" The voices of both individuals sounded angry now, but I was only vaguely listening. What consumed my attention was the dynamics of their energy fields. When the discussion began, Phil and I had backed up a few feet, and Sarah and the taller man had squared off, facing each other with a distance of about 4 feet between them. Immediately, both their energy fields had seemed to grow more dense and excited somehow, as though from an inner vibration. As the conversation progressed, their fields began to intermingle. When one of them made a point, his field would create a movement which seemed to suck at the other's field with what appeared to be a kind of vacuum maneuver. But then, as the other person made his rebuttal, the energy would move back in his direction. In terms of the dynamics of energy fields, winning the point seemed to mean capturing part of the opponent's field and pulling it into oneself. "Besides," Sarah was saying to the man, "we have observed the phenomena we're trying to understand." The man gave Sarah a disdainful look. "Then you are insane as well as incompetent," he said, and walked away. "You're a dinosaur," Sarah shouted, which made Phil and me laugh. Sarah, however, was still tense. "These people can make me angry," Sarah said as we resumed our walk along the path. "Forget it," Phil said. "These kinds of people come around sometimes." "But why so many?" Sarah asked. "And why right now?" As we walked up to the lodge, I could see Will at the Jeep. The doors of the vehicle were open and gear was spread out on top of the hood. He saw me immediately and motioned for me to come over. "Well, looks like I'm about to take off," I said. My comment broke a 10-minute silence, which had begun when I had tried to explain what I had seen happen to Sarah's energy during the argument. Evidently, I had not put it very well, because my comments had provoked only blank stares, and had cast us all into a long period of self-absorption. "It's been nice meeting you," Sarah said, offering her hand. Phil was looking toward the Jeep. "Is that Will James?" he asked. "Is he the guy you're traveling with?" "Yes," I said. "Why?" "I just wondered. I've seen him around. He knows the owner of this place and was one of the early group that first encouraged the research on energy fields here." "Come on up and meet him," I said. "No, I have to go," he said. "I'll see you around here later on. I know you won't be able to stay away." "No doubt," I said. Sarah interjected that she too needed to go, and that I could contact her through the lodge. I delayed them for a few more minutes, expressing my thanks for the lessons. Sarah's expression grew serious. "Seeing the energy, grasping this new way of perceiving the physical world, grows through a kind of contagion. We don't understand it, but when a person hangs out with others who see this energy, usually they begin to see it too. So, go show it to someone else." I nodded and then hurried up to the Jeep. Will greeted me with a smile. "Are you about ready?" I asked. "Almost," he said. "How did the morning go?" "Interesting," I said. "I've got a lot to talk to you about." "You'd better save it for now," he said. "We need to get out of here. Things are looking unfriendly." I walked closer to him. "What's going on?" I asked. "Nothing too serious," he said. "I'll explain later. Get your stuff." I walked into the lodge and picked up the few items I had left in my room. Will had told me earlier there would be no charge, courtesy of the owner. So I walked down to the desk and handed the clerk my key and walked back outside to the Jeep. Will was under the hood checking something, and he slammed it closed as I walked up. "Okay," he said. "Let's go." We drove out of the parking lot, then down the drive toward the main road. Several cars were leaving at the same time. "So what's happening?" I asked Will. "A group of local officials," he replied, "along with some scientific types, have complained about the people associated with this conference center. They're not alleging that anything illegal is going on, just that some of the folks hanging around here may be what they call undesirable, not legitimate scientists. These officials could cause a lot of trouble, and that could effectively put the lodge out of business." I looked at him blankly, and he continued, "You see, this lodge normally has several groups booked at any one time. Only a small number have anything to do with research associated with the manuscript. The others are groups focused on their own disciplines who come down here for the beauty. If the officials get too ugly and create a negative climate, these groups will stop meeting here. But I thought you said the local officials wouldn't tamper with the tourist money coming into Vicente. I didn't think they would. Someone has them nervous about the manuscript. Did anyone in the gardens understand what was occurring? No, not really, I said. They were just wondering why all of a sudden more angry people were around. Will remained silent. We drove out the gate and turned southeast. A mile later, we took another road which headed due east toward the mountain range in the distance. We'll be going right by the gardens, Will said after a while. Ahead, I saw the plots and the first metal building. As we came alongside, the door opened and I met eyes with the person coming out. It was Marjorie. She smiled and turned toward me as we passed, our gaze lingering for a long moment. Who was that? Will asked. A woman I met yesterday, I answered. He nodded, then changed the subject. Did you get a look at the Third Insight? I was given a copy. Will didn't reply, appearing to be lost in thought, so I pulled out the translation and found where I had stopped reading. From there, the Third Insight elaborated on the nature of beauty, describing this perception as the one through which humans would eventually learn to observe energy fields. Once this occurred, it said, then our understanding of the physical universe would quickly transform. For instance, we would begin to eat more foods which were still alive with this energy, and we would become conscious that certain localities radiate more energy than others, the highest radiation coming from old natural environments, especially forests. I was about to read the final pages when Will suddenly spoke. Tell me what you experienced back at the gardens, he said. As best I could, I related in detail the events of the 2 days, including the people I had met. When I told him of the encounter with Marjorie, he looked at me and smiled. How much did you talk to these people about the other insights and how these insights relate to what they're doing in the gardens? He asked. I didn't mention them at all, I replied. I didn't trust them at first, and later I just figured they knew more than me. I think you could have given them some important information had you been perfectly honest with them. What kind of information? He looked at me warmly. Only you know that. I was at a loss for words, so I looked at the landscape. The terrain was growing increasingly hilly and rocky. Large granite outcrops overhung the road. What do you make of seeing Marjorie again as we passed the gardens? Will asked. I started to say, just a coincidence, but instead I said, I don't know. What do you think? I don't think anything happens by coincidence. To me it means you two have unfinished business, something you needed to say to each other that you didn't. The idea intrigued me, but disturbed me as well. I'd been accused all my life of remaining too distant, of asking questions but not expressing opinions or committing to a position. Why, I wondered, was this coming up again now? I also noticed that I was beginning to feel differently. At Vicente, I had felt adventurous and competent, and now I was feeling what could only be called a growing depression mixed with anxiety. Now you've made me depressed, I said. He laughed loudly, then replied, It wasn't me. It was the effect of leaving the Vicente estate. The energy of that place makes you high as a kite. Why do you think all these scientists began hanging around here years ago? They don't have a clue as to why they like it so much. He turned to look directly at me. But we do, don't we? He checked the road, then looked at me again, his face full of regard. You have to crank up your own energy when you leave a place like that. I just looked at him, puzzled, and he gave me a reassuring smile. Afterward, we were both silent for perhaps a mile. Then he said, Tell me more of what happened at the gardens. I continued the story. When I described actually seeing energy fields, he looked at me with amazement, but said nothing. Can you see these fields? I asked. He shot me a glance. Yes, he said. Go on. I related the story without interruption until I came to Sarah's argument with the Peruvian scientist and the dynamics of their energy fields during the confrontation. "What did Sarah and Phil say about that?" he asked. "Nothing," I said. "They didn't seem to have a frame of reference for it."
"I didn't think so," Will said. "They're so fascinated with a third insight, they haven't yet gone forward. How humans compete for energy is the fourth insight."
"Compete for energy?" I asked. He merely smiled, nodding toward the translation I was holding. I picked up where I had left off. The text pointed clearly to the fourth insight. It said that eventually, humans would see the universe as comprised of one dynamic energy, an energy that can sustain us and respond to our expectations. Yet we would also see that we have been disconnected from the larger source of this energy, that we have cut ourselves off, and so have felt weak and insecure and lacking. In the face of this deficit, we humans have always sought to increase our personal energy in the only manner we have known, by seeking to psychologically steal it from others, an unconscious competition that underlies all human conflict in the world. The struggle for power. A pothole in the gravel road jolted the Jeep and woke me up. I looked at my watch, 3 p.m. As I stretched and attempted to fully awaken, I felt a sharp pain in the small of my back. The drive had been grueling. After leaving Vicente, we had traveled the entire day, riding in several different directions, as though Will were looking for something he couldn't find. We had spent the night at a small inn where the beds were hard and lumpy, and I had slept little. Now, after traveling hard for the second day in a row, I was ready to complain. I looked over at Will. He was focused on the road and so intent and alert that I decided not to interrupt him. He seemed to be in the same serious mood he had displayed several hours ago when he had stopped the Jeep and told me we needed to talk. "Do you remember that I told you the insights had to be discovered one at a time?" he had asked. "Yes." "Do you believe that each will indeed present itself?" "Well, they have so far," I said half-humorously. Will looked at me with a serious expression. "Finding the third insight was easy. All we had to do was visit Vicente. From now on, running across the other insights may be much more difficult." He paused for a moment, then said, "I think that we should go south to a small village near Quilabamba, a place called Kula. There's another virgin forest up there that I think you should see. But it's vitally important that you stay alert. Coincidences will occur regularly, but you have to notice them. Do you understand?" I told him I thought I did and that I would keep what he said in mind. After that, the conversation had lapsed and I had fallen into a deep sleep. A sleep I now regretted because of what it had done to my back. I stretched again and Will looked over at me. "Where are we?" I asked. "In the Andes again," he said. The hills had turned into high ridges and distant valleys. The vegetation was coarser now, the trees smaller and wind-blown. Inhaling deeply, I noticed the air was thinner and cool. "Better put on this jacket," Will said, pulling a brown cotton windbreaker from a bag. "It'll be cold up here this afternoon." Ahead, as the road rounded a bend, we could see a narrow crossroads. On one side, near a white-framed store and gas station, a vehicle was parked with the hood open. Tools lay on a cloth covering the fender. As we drove past, a blonde man walked out of the store and glanced at us briefly. He was round-faced and wore dark-rimmed glasses. I looked at the man closely, my mind racing back 5 years. "I know it wasn't him," I said to Will. "But that guy looks just like a friend of mine I used to work with. I haven't thought of him in years." I noticed Will was scrutinizing me. "I told you to watch events closely," he said. "Let's go back and see if that fellow needs some help." He didn't look like a local. We found a place where the shoulders of the road were wide enough and turned around. When we returned to the store, the man was working on the engine. Will pulled up to the pump and leaned out the window. "Looks like you have trouble," Will said. The man pushed his glasses back up on his nose, a habit my friend also shared.
Yes, he replied. I have lost my water pump.
The man appeared to be in his early 40s and was of a slight build. His English was formal, with a French accent. Will was quickly out of the vehicle, introducing us. The man offered me his hand with a smile that also looked familiar. His name was Chris Renault.
You sound French, I said.
I am, he replied. But I teach psychology in Brazil. I am here in Peru seeking information about an archaeological artifact that has been found, a manuscript. I hesitated for a moment, unsure how much I should trust him.
We're here for the same reason, I finally said.
He looked at me with deep interest.
What can you tell me about it? He asked. Have you seen copies?
Before I could reply, Will walked out of the building, the screen door slamming behind him.
Great luck, he said to me. The owner has a place where we can camp, and there's some hot food. We might as well stay for the night.
He turned and looked expectantly at Renault.
If you don't mind sharing your reservations.
No, no, he said. I welcome the company. A new pump cannot be delivered here until tomorrow morning. While he and Will began a conversation about the mechanics and reliability of Renault's Land Cruiser, I leaned back against the Jeep, feeling the warmth of the sun and drifting into a pleasant reverie about the old friend Renault had brought to mind. My friend had been wide-eyed and curious, very much like Renault seemed, and a constant reader of books. I could almost recall the theories he liked, but time had obscured my recollection.
"Let's get our stuff down to the campsite," Will was saying, patting me on the back.
Okay, I said absently. He opened the rear door and pulled out the tent and sleeping bags and loaded my arms, then grabbed a duffel bag full of extra clothing. Renault was locking up his vehicle. We all walked past the store and down a course of steps. The ridge fell away steeply behind the building, and we angled to the left along a narrow pathway. After 20 or 30 yards, we could hear water running. And further on, we saw a stream cascading down the rocks. The air was cooler, and I could smell the strong fragrance of mint. Directly in front of us, the ground leveled out and the stream formed a pool about 25 feet in diameter. Someone had cleared a campsite and built a rock containment for a fire. Wood was stacked against a nearby tree.
"This is fine," Will said, and began unpacking his large four-man tent.
Renault spread his smaller tent to the right of Will.
"Are you and Will researchers?" Renault asked me at one point.
Will had finished with the tent and had walked up to check on dinner.
"Wilson's a guide," I said. "I'm not doing much of anything right now."
Renault gave me a puzzled look. I smiled and asked, "Have you been able to see any parts of the manuscript?"
"I have seen the first and second insights," he said, stepping closer, "and I'll tell you something. I think it is all happening just as the manuscript says. We are changing our world view. I can see it in psychology."
"What do you mean?" He took a breath.
"My field is conflict, looking at why humans treat each other so violently. We've always known that this violence comes from the urge humans feel to control and dominate one another, but only recently have we studied this phenomenon from the inside, from the point of view of the individual's consciousness. We have asked, what happens inside a human being that makes him want to control someone else? We have found that when an individual walks up to another person and engages in a conversation, which happens billions of times each day in the world, one of two things can happen. That individual can come away feeling strong or feeling weak, depending on what occurs in the interaction." I gave him a puzzled look, and he appeared slightly embarrassed at having rushed into a long lecture on the subject. I asked him to go on.
"For this reason," he added, "we humans always seem to take a manipulative posture. No matter what the particulars of the situation or the subject matter, we prepare ourselves to say whatever we must in order to prevail in the conversation. Each of us seeks to find some way to control and thus remain on top of the encounter. If we are successful, if our viewpoint prevails, then rather than feel weak, we receive a psychological boost. In other words, We humans seek to outwit and control each other, not just because of some tangible goal in the outside world that we're trying to achieve, but because of a lift we get psychologically. This is the reason we see so many irrational conflicts in the world, both at the individual level and at the level of nations. The consensus in my field is that this whole matter is now emerging into public consciousness. We humans are realizing how much we manipulate each other, and consequently, we're reevaluating our motivations. We're looking for another way to interact. I think this reevaluation will be part of the new world view that the manuscript speaks of. Our conversation was interrupted as Will walked up. "They're ready to serve us," he said. We hurried up the path and into the basement level of the building, the family's living quarters. We walked through the living room and into the dining area. On the table was a hot meal of stew, vegetables, and salad. "Sit down, sit down," the proprietor was saying in English, pulling out chairs and rushing about. Behind him stood an older woman, apparently his wife, and a teenage girl of about 15. While taking his seat, Will accidentally brushed his fork with an arm. It fell noisily to the floor. The man glared at the woman, who in turn spoke harshly to the young girl who had not yet moved to bring a new one. She hurried into the other room and returned, holding a fork, then handed it tentatively to Will. Her back was stooped, and her right hand shook slightly. My eyes met Renaud's from across the table. "Enjoy the food," the man said, handing me one of the dishes. For most of the meal, Renaud and Will talked casually about academic life, the challenges of teaching and publishing. The proprietor had left the room, but the woman stood just inside the door. As the woman and her daughter began serving individual dishes of pie, the young girl's elbow hit my glass of water, spilling the water on the table in front of me. The older woman rushed over in a rage, shouting at the girl in Spanish and pushing her out of the way. "I am very sorry," the woman said, wiping up the water. "The girl is so clumsy." The young girl exploded, flinging the remaining pie at the woman, missing, and splattering pie and broken china across the middle of the table, just as the proprietor returned. The old man shouted, and the girl ran from the room. "I'm sorry," he said, hurrying to the table. "It's no problem," I replied. "Don't be so hard on the girl." Will was on his feet, figuring the bill, and we quickly left. Renaud had been quiet, but as we walked through the door and down the steps, he spoke. "Did you see that girl?" he asked, looking at me. "She is a classic example of psychological violence. This is what the human need to control others leads to when taken to the extreme. The old man and woman are dominating the girl, totally. Did you see how nervous and stooped she was?" "Yes," I said, "but it appears she's about fed up." "Exactly. Her parents have never let up, and from her point of view, she has no choice but to lash out violently. It is the only way she can gain some control for herself. Unfortunately, when she grows up because of this early trauma, she will think she has to seize control and dominate others with the same intensity. This characteristic will be deeply ingrained and will make her just as dominating as her parents are now, especially when she is around people who are vulnerable, such as children. In fact, this same trauma no doubt happened to her parents before her. They have to dominate now because of the way their parents dominated them. That's the means through which psychological violence is passed down from one generation to another." Renaud stopped suddenly. "I need to get my sleeping bag out of the truck," he said. "I'll be down in a second." I nodded, and Will and I continued toward the campsite. "You and Renaud have been talking a lot," Will remarked. "Yes, we have," I said. He smiled. "Actually, Renaud has been doing most of the talking. You listen and answer direct questions, but you don't offer much." "I'm interested in what he has to say," I said defensively. Will ignored my tone. "Did you see the energy moving between the members of that family? The man and woman were sucking the child's energy into themselves until she was almost dead." "I forgot to watch the energy flow," I said. "Well, don't you think Renaud would like to see it? What do you make of running into him in the first place?" "I don't know." "Don't you think it has some meaning?"
We were driving down the road, and you see someone who reminds you of an old friend, and when we meet him, he happens to also be looking for the manuscript? Doesn't that sound beyond coincidence? Yes. Perhaps you met so that you could receive some information that will extend your journey here. And doesn't it follow that perhaps you have some information for him as well? Yes, I guess so. What do you think I should tell him? Will again looked at me with his characteristic warmth. The truth, he said. Before I could say anything else, Renault came bounding down the path toward us. I brought a flashlight in case we need it later, he said. For the first time, I became aware of the twilight and looked west. The sun had already set, but the sky was still a bright orange. The few clouds in that direction carried a darker reddish color. For an instant, I thought I saw a whitish field of light around the plants in the foreground, but the image faded. Beautiful sunset, I said. Then noticed Will had disappeared into his tent, and Renault was pulling a sleeping bag from its case. Yes, it is, Renault said distractedly without looking. I walked over to where he was working. He looked up and said, I didn't get to ask you. What insights have you seen? The first two were only described to me, I replied. But we just spent the last 2 days at the Vicente Lodge near Satipo. While we were there, one of the people doing research gave me a copy of the third insight. It's pretty amazing. His eyes lit up. Do you have it with you? Yes. Do you want to look at it? He jumped at the opportunity and took it into his tent to read. I found some matches, an old newspaper, and started the fire. After it was burning brightly, Will crawled out of his tent. Where's Renault? He asked. He's reading the translation Sarah gave me, I said. Will walked over and sat on a smooth log someone had placed near the fire area. I joined him. Darkness had finally descended and nothing could be seen except for the bare outline of the trees to our left, the dim lights from the station behind us, and a muted glow from Renault's tent. The woods were alive with night sounds, some of which I had never heard before. After about 30 minutes, Renault emerged from his tent, the flashlight in his hand. He walked over and sat at my left. Will was yawning. That insight is amazing, he said. Could anyone there actually see those energy fields? I briefly told him of my experiences, beginning with our arrival and proceeding through the point where I actually saw fields myself. He was silent for a minute, then he asked, They were actually doing experiments where they projected their own energy onto plants and affected the plant's growth? It affected their nutritional potency too, I said. But the main insight is broader than that, he commented almost to himself. The third insight is that the universe on the whole is made up of this energy, and we can affect perhaps not only plants, but other things as well, just by what we do with the energy that belongs to us, the part we can control. He paused for a minute. I wonder how we affect other people with our energy. Will looked at me and smiled. I'll tell you what I saw, I said. I witnessed an argument between two people, and their energies were doing really strange things. Renault pushed up his glasses again. Tell me about that. Will stood up at this point. I think I need to turn in, he said. It's been a long day. We both said goodnight and Will entered his tent. Afterward, I described as best I could what Sarah and the other scientists had said to each other, emphasizing the action of their energy fields. Now, wait a minute, Renault said. You saw their energies pulling at each other, trying to, say, capture each other as they argued? That's right, I said. He was thoughtful for a few seconds. We must analyze this fully. We had two people arguing over who had the correct view of the situation, over who was right, each seeking to win out over the other, even to the point of invalidating the other's confidence and to outright name-calling. Suddenly he looked up. Yes, this all makes sense. What do you mean? I said. The movement of this energy, if we can systematically observe it, is a way to understand what humans are receiving when we compete and argue and harm each other.
When we control another human being, we receive their energy. We fill up at the other's expense, and the filling up is what motivates us. Look, I must learn how to see these energy fields. Where is this Vicente Lodge? How do I get there? I told him the general location, but said he would have to ask Will for specific directions. Yes, I'll do that tomorrow, he said with commitment. For now, I should get some sleep. I want to leave as early as possible. He said goodnight, then disappeared into his tent, leaving me alone with the crackling fire and the night sounds.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 2 of The Celestine Prophecy. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 3.